when you look at these texts that clearly show an order to the way God worked in our life, if I'm wrong on this free will issue, my tendency is to reverse that order. And for instance, most people you will listen to will describe being born again as what happens to people who believe, right? If you will believe, you will be born again. That's not what the Bible says. The Bible says, 1 John 5:1, those who have been born of God do believe. It reverses that order. So again, if I'm wrong on free will, it's perfectly fine with me to think that man has the capacity to believe and therefore cause their own new birth. But if we're thinking biblically, we know that's not the right order. And again, so this even helps me in the way that I think what God's done in my life, those kind of things. Ministry strategy, it affects that. Prayer, I mean, think if you will, going back to the evangelism thing, if I thought God's sovereignty, just we didn't do anything and God just determined everything, I wouldn't pray, right? But then at the same time, if I believe in man's free will and I downplay God's sovereignty, why on earth would I pray at all? God can't do anything to that person that person doesn't allow him to. And so it deals with your prayer. It deals with your sanctification. It deals with trusting God's providence. There's several things you can go through that make this conversation worth having. Before we begin on this several week study, I want to be clear that I am not interested at all in what we call burning straw men. That happens all the time in this kind of a discussion where, oh, you're an Arminian, then you don't believe God's sovereign. It's like, okay, wait. Just to be fair, they do think they believe in it. We just don't agree on what that means. Does that make sense? Or they'll say, oh, you're a Calvinist, then you believe we're robots. Okay, to be fair, I don't believe we're robots. Like, so let's be fair with one another or else we're never going to, it'll sound very, you know, like political language today where you just talk past each other and trade talking points. And the conversation, I've said this before, usually gives off more heat than light. And that's what we want to do in this Sunday school, is shed some light on this issue. What does the Bible say about free will? So know from the beginning here, and I'm conceding this, okay? Most of the Christians that you know, most of the Christians you talk to, and most of the Christians you listen to will affirm a what we call a libertarian free will. Most people you run into will affirm a definition of free will that we here at Cornerstone just don't agree with. We don't find it biblical. So when you hear what we're saying, I expect it to be a little, well, that's not what so-and-so says, because most people that you're familiar with and run into, and me as well, they don't affirm what we're going to put forward. And I agree with that. The problem gets, if you can back up a little bit outside of McPherson in 2018 and look at church history, that group would dwindle down a little bit as far as who confesses what. And we'll do some of that along the way. But what I've found, and this is echoed in some of the books that I've recommended, is when you talk with people about what they believe about free will, rarely will you get a definition of free will. Does that make sense? So if you went up to somebody and said, do you believe in free will? And they said, yes. Well, what do you mean by that? And they go, well, I believe we make choices. Well, that doesn't actually distinguish you. Like, I believe we make choices. Everyone who, or majority of people who are Christians believe we make choices. That's not the debate. That's not the argument. So I want to pull from people who represent these different viewpoints and get some definitions that'll be helpful. And I want to share them with you as we go along. The two main views that we'll discuss, and I can't remember what your sheet looks like, so I'll do my best to fill it out for you. If I miss one, just shoot your hand up. Or if along the way there's a question about anything, just shoot your hand up. But the two main views that we'll be talking about are these. It's number one view is called libertarian free will. And this is not to be associated with the, as I said before, the political position of libertarianism. I'm not commenting on that. This is a specific view of free will from the Bible that are held by primarily two people. And these two people don't like being lumped together, but they are lumped together in this, okay? And that's number one, it's held by people who we would call historically Arminians, okay? Libertarian free will is held by people who are historically going to be referred to as Arminians. And then more recently, it's also held to by people called open theists. Does anybody in here, besides one person that I'm thinking of right now, does anybody in here know what an open theist is? You can't raise your hand. Anybody know what an open theist is? Raise your hand if you've never heard that before. It's also called process theology. okay, anyone that I said couldn't answer, anyone want to answer that? Well, give us a short, quick definition of what your understanding of open theology is. Open theist, I mean. Go ahead. No, yeah, so that would be like a, yeah, that would just be like a pluralistic type. Yeah, so this one is process theology, open theism, stuff like that. It's basically, and I'm probably shortchanging them a little bit, but God just doesn't know the future, okay? Because of their view of libertarian free will, the only way to actually have free will in their mind is for God to not know or determine the future. Is that fair? Would you say? Right? Nate, you, right? So I know three guys in here who know what I'm talking about at least. And the logic is this. Does God know what you're going to eat tomorrow for lunch? And I'm asking you guys, not open theists. Does God know what you're going to eat for lunch tomorrow? Absolutely. So then is there any possibility that you won't eat that tomorrow? No. So then they go, well, then that's not free will, so therefore God doesn't know the future. One of the main proponents of this, Greg Boyd, we'll quote from him later. I remember when 9/11 happened, and he wrote a blog or a book. I can't remember where I got the quote from. But he basically put his arm around someone and said, God is just as caught off guard by this as you are. And that's open theology. And I'm not trying to be rude, but I think they just take the Arminian view of free will to its logical conclusion. That if libertarian free will is true, then I agree, God can't know the future. Well, I definitely know that God knows the future and even determined it, so my problem's with libertarian free will. Does that make sense? If you're an Arminian, you're holding to libertarian free will and God's sovereignty just inconsistently. You're not being consistent here. And this is how sometimes, I'm telling you, this is, we, and I'm saying we do this, like everyone does this. You protect what you believe so much so that you will sometimes affirm the most ludicrous statements just to protect what you believe. I was in a conversation with someone, and I was making this point. I said, if God knows the future, then we can't have the freedom that you think we have. We do have a certain freedom. I'm not saying we don't. But let's just say, for instance, does God know that I'm going to have grandkids? Anyone in here? Do you affirm that God at least knows I'm going to have grandkids? I'm not saying how he knows it or anything like that. It's just he knows it. Does he also know where that grandchild, let's name him Jimmy, okay? Does he also know where that grandchild will go for eternity? Yes. So therefore, does Jimmy actually have any opportunity to not go where God already knows he's going to go? And that's the conundrum. It's like, And so they'll say, well, yeah, but God only knows it because he chose, like the person, and you just see smoke come out, right? The open theist just says, well, yeah, that's a good point, so therefore God doesn't know the future. And they love to harp on the verses in the Bible where God changed his mind, he repented, Jesus didn't know things. They love those kind of verses. Anyway, I say this because this is the main view that we will be talking about, discussing, and offering an alternative to. Libertarian free will, it's held by open theists and Arminians. The other view, and this is the one that we would defend here and explain from the Bible, is called compatibilism. That God's sovereignty and man's... And I'll define free will later, but God's sovereignty and man's free will are compatible with each other. That whole conundrum is not really a conundrum, and we'll talk about that in a minute. There is a third view called hard determinism, and that's held by hyper-Calvinists. And like I said, you don't have to worry about them because you'll never bump into them because they don't do anything. So you'll be okay. Those conversations are pointless to have because God's already determined what you believe anyway, so they won't have them. This is rare and we won't discuss it. So that's about as much as we'll get into on that one. So here's my question. I think this is where your sheet picks up. I'm not sure. But what do we mean by free will? When someone asks you, what do you believe in free will? It's kind of like this charge. When people come up to me, and this has happened before, and they go, well, don't you believe in predestination? Let me ask you this question. Is the word predestination in the Bible? Yes. It's in the Bible, right? That doesn't mean my view is, it's just that word's there. So is it a helpful question to ask, do you believe in predestination? Well, it's not a helpful question. What would be a more helpful question? Yeah, what do you believe about that word, right? So when you bring this conversation up and you say, do you believe in free will? Well, that doesn't actually tell me what you mean by free will. Like I would affirm that in one sense, but I don't in another. So that's not the helpful question. The helpful question is, what do we mean by free will? Because all of us affirm some sort of freedom or willingness on man. And this is where the dividing line is. So libertarians, this is their definition. And this is, you've got to get this point. Lock this point away for the rest of our weeks of study, okay? For libertarian, that is Arminians and open theists, free will exists when we could have done something contrary to what we did. Okay? Let me read it a different way. Free will exists when we have the ability to choose contrary to any prior factors or influence over our choices. So think of the way your life has brought you to the point you're at right now. Well, they're saying you only have free will if all of that doesn't determine what you do. Does that make sense? I'll read it again. They say that free will exists when we have the ability to choose contrary to any prior factors that influence our choices. This includes external circumstances, our motives, our desires, our character, our nature, even God. If I can't make a decision that isn't caused by those things, then I don't actually have free will, is what they say. So if God causes a decision I have, that's not free will. If my circumstances cause a decision, that's not free will. If my even if my heart causes a decision. Now, real quick, does anybody know what we studied for 12 weeks last quarter? The heart. What is the relationship between your heart and your decisions? Yeah, your decisions come from your heart. They say no. In order for you to have free will, not even your heart can determine your decisions. And so even just on that level, what we studied last quarter helps us out with this study. Your heart, your life does flow from your heart. Your whatever nature your heart it has, whatever state your heart's in, that's the state your life is in. If the prior influences decisively determine choices, then freedom and responsibility are hindered. Meaning, if I was caused by something outside of myself, or even inside of myself, if I was caused to do this, that wasn't a real choice, and I can't be held responsible. Does that make sense? This is why some people go to court and they plead what? Insanity. I couldn't help it. And even our legal system goes, oh, well, then we'll treat this person differently because they couldn't help it. And that's the libertarian view of free will. They say you can always help it. In fact, nothing that's ever happened in your life can ever cause you to do anything. God can't cause you to do anything except in very rare cases that they'll even admit that. We'll call this view, and this is the easy way to remember it, they believe in free will that's defined by contrary choice, okay? And you'll see why I make this distinction in a minute. In their mind, you have free will only if you could have done something else. Does that make sense? So you're riding down the road, there's somebody stranded on the side of the road. Why is it a good thing that and should be praised that you stopped and helped that person? What could you have done? Could have kept going. So they say in that moment you had free will because you could have kept going, but you decided to stop. That's not how we would define free will. But notice, they get their meaning for decisions and their meaning for choices from the fact that you could have done something else. So for them, if it's not possible to do anything else but what you did, that's not really freedom. Do you get that? We've got to get that because this morning will make no sense if we don't get that point. For them, if you couldn't do anything but what you did, that's not freedom. And I'll show in a minute why that doesn't hold up biblically. Don't miss this nuance. A person can choose, according to them, to do what they want to do, but they can just as easily choose what they don't want to do. Does that make sense? There's no extra tugging or pulling either way. They can do A and they can do non-A, and it's just basically a flip of the coin. Those influences can't determine any choice. You could have the same exact life you've had up to now and make a totally different decision than you did this morning to come to church, is what they're saying. That nothing can be said to determine or influence your decisions ultimately. If they can't, like they would say, then they didn't really choose what they chose. For them, our choices cannot be determined by anything. A self-determining choice or autonomous, right? Autonomous, auto, self, nomos, law, self-law. We don't, they're saying we affirm autonomous choice. You govern yourself. Your heart doesn't influence you. God doesn't influence you. Outside sources don't influence you. You are autonomous. For them, we are always in total control. Nothing inside or outside can determine our choices. So, if that's the definition of free will that they have, what on earth does a compatibilist have? A definition of free will for the compatibilist is what we would hold to, and it's this. People have free will because they voluntarily chose what they most wanted to choose. It says nothing of what you could have done. It just speaks to why you did what you did do. Does that make sense? So if I'm riding down the road and I stop and help this person on the side of the road, that was a free choice I just made because I wanted to make that choice. I wasn't forced to make that choice by anything else. I wanted to make that. Now we can talk about why I wanted to later, but the point is, my understanding, and I think the Bible's understanding, will I think prove it decisively in a minute. My freedom of choice is not determined by what I could have done, but why I did do what I did. So if you say, Josh, do you believe in free will? I say, absolutely. I absolutely believe in free will. People only do what they most deeply want to do. They freely choose everything they choose. Does that make sense? I'm not saying yes because man can just do anything at any time he wants to. Those are two very different definitions. You guys better be glad I'm wearing a watch because this thing says 8:34 and I just fixed it this morning. It is 8:59. Anyway, I'm putting that down. So I'm freely deciding I want to put that down right now. You got to get this clear, though. Our choices proceed from the most compelling motives and desires that we have, which in turn is conditioned on our base nature, whether good or evil. We call this one, they call it freedom of contrary choice. We call this one freedom of inclination. When I say you have free will, I mean everything you've ever chosen to do, you wanted to do it. That's why you chose it. You freely chose it. When they say free will, they say yes, because you could have done anything. That's the difference. This leaves room for a dual explanation, the compatibilist. In our view, God can determine what happens, and we can truly want what happens at the same time. Does that make sense? We have that ability to explain that. That's why that conundrum of how does God know what you're going to eat tomorrow for lunch, but yet you still choose what you eat tomorrow for lunch, can coexist, and that's why we call it compatibilism. They're compatible with one another. Because tomorrow, whatever you eat for lunch, and now you're going to think about it. Tomorrow when you eat lunch, you're going to giggle a little bit. When you pick your lunch tomorrow, you freely chose it because you wanted to pick that. And that's exactly what God determined you would pick. It works together. It's compatible. So what I want to do the next 3 weeks, and I hijacked this a little bit. We will not end this in the normal quarter that we've normally done. We will probably go 14 or 15 weeks on this. And the reason is mainly these next 3 weeks. In this book here, he offers three of the most common arguments for supporting libertarian free will. And rather than cramming that into one, I wanted to take a week at a time on each one. So what I want to do today is on your sheet, I've got this. Is there something I've skipped so far? I'm about to get to the three main arguments. Is there something on your sheet I've skipped? Which one? This one is called What About Free Will? And again, this is, for me, this is the best book I've read on the issue in my entire life. All 30 years. Anyway, I know that's not a lot to some, and it's a lot to others, so we'll see. But here's what I want to do. Over the next 3 weeks, I want to spend a week at a time on each of these three arguments. So today we'll deal with the first one. And their three arguments are this. I think I've got three blanks on the front side of your sheet. Their three arguments are this. First, libertarian free will, or their definition of free will, is the only way to have a meaningful relationship with God. So in their view, if you love God and you couldn't have done anything else but love God, that's not real love. I mean, imagine if you will, I went up to Danae and she says, why do you love me? And I say, because I have to. It's like, well, I love that, right? I mean, that's not love, right? So that's their argument. We'll deal with that today. Secondly, their definition of free will, libertarian free will, undergirds moral responsibility. So again, if I'm driving somewhere and John used the Krispy Kreme illustration, when the light comes on, your car just goes in. So let's say the car actually did just go in. Can he be held responsible for that car going into the parking lot? No, because the car just did it. It couldn't help but do it. So their understanding of free will, they say, if we can't help but do what we do, then we can't be held responsible. It's like the insanity plea. I couldn't help it. And so when God says, why didn't you believe in Jesus? Well, I couldn't. I couldn't help it. And so we'll deal with that one next week. Thirdly, their definition of free will, libertarian free will, rescues God from being culpable for evil. So in their mind, they say, well, if you're just doing what God determined you would do, then that means God determined Hitler would do what Hitler did, and therefore, who's the ultimate cause of evil? God. If people only do what God determined they would do, and people do evil, then God determined evil. And they say that's not okay. And so we'll deal with that one in 2 weeks. But this morning, I want to dive into the first argument. And this one's fun because me and Seth were joking earlier this week. Guys are studying the Trinity at Iron Man. Any argument you can root in the Trinity is a bonus, like way to go. Because everybody knows the Trinity is biblical. If I can prove something from the Trinity, I feel like it's okay, it's over. Like the Trinity, this is how they function. It's true. Move on. But before we get that way, listen to their argument, okay? Libertarians say that free will, libertarian free will, and remember, that's freedom of contrary choice, that you can choose anything else. It establishes a meaningful relationship with God. They say only if we're free to accept or reject God can we have a meaningful relationship by accepting him. And I get that on the surface, right? I mean, that works everywhere else. I mean, if I'm not free to reject Danae's love, then do we really have love for one another? That's really weird to think about. They see Calvinism or compatibilism as an attack on personal relationship. Now, here's what I want you to do. What did we study last week? I know it's on the spot, but what did we study last week? What was the big point from last week? Everything ever exists in order to glorify God. Now, I want you to listen. Think about that point as I read this quote. So Greg Boyd, an open theist, holds to libertarian free will. Listen to what he says. So let me ask you this. Before we read this, what is the point of everything in the universe to glorify God? Listen to this. He says, if love is the ultimate goal of creation, well, no, it's not. So whatever you're about to say, anyway, let's go back. If love is the goal of creation, what are its conditions? The first condition of love is that it must be freely chosen. It cannot be coerced. Agents must possess the capacity and opportunity to reject love if they are to possess the genuine capacity and ability to engage in love. And so he sees the ultimate purpose of creation as relationship. That's why last week is so important. He's already exalted man's experience above the ultimate purpose, God's glory. Man's experience serves the purpose of the greater purpose, God's glory. He exalts it. And he says this, and listen to his argument. If I can't freely choose to reject or accept love, then it really, I'm not able to engage in love. It's not real love. Compare this, like I said, to what we studied last week. What was the purpose of everything last week? It's God's glory. So let me evaluate this with the time we have left. This argument's problematic for a couple reasons. Let's assume that someone's compelled to do something. Just that general language. Well, you can't compel someone to love you. Let's think about this. There's kind of three ways, and this is where Thaddeus, great name, Thaddeus Williams talks about the language of compelling, okay? So someone's compelled to say, I love you. Let's say that. One way they could be compelled is you could program them, right? Like the Woody doll, there's a snake in my boots, or I had Pee Wee Herman growing up. I was like, you know, you pull it and you pull the string, that's coming out. He's programmed. Does that make sense? That's going to happen every time. Pee Wee wasn't actually saying, ha, ha, ha. Like that wasn't him. It's not Woody. Like you pull a string, he's not actually doing, he's programmed to do it. So he's compelled to do it by robotic formula or whatever. Yeah. That's not biblical, obviously. Secondly, there's also divine coercion. It is, I mean, logically possible that God could cause you to say, I love you. No, you will say, I love you, but I don't want to. Well, you will say it, which is usually how Calvinists get painted, right? Oh, so you're telling me that people go to heaven whether they want to or not, and people go to hell whether they want to or not? It's like, no, it's not what we're saying. So number one, you could have a mechanistic kind of mechanical programming that compels you. Secondly, you could have a divine coercion. This person's forced by God to say, I love you, even though they don't want to. Thirdly, you could have this, and this is what I think is biblical, and the libertarian would say, no, it's not, but I'll argue in a second it is. A person could be compelled to say, I love you, because of a strong internal affection for God that he or she cannot fathom acting in any other way. I mean, think right now, if you're a Christian, think of not loving Christ. Is that even possible? It's like, no way. I know who he is. I know what he's done. My heart's been changed. Like, there's no way I would hate Christ. And I say, well, then you've been compelled to love him by a new heart. And they would say, well, then that's not free will, because you're being compelled to love him. That's not real love. And I go, no, it is real love, because the reason you love him right now is because you really do want to love him. You see how the two definitions of free will are playing with each other now? I'm saying if you are in here this morning and you love Christ and you really do want to love Christ, you are freely loving him because you want to love him. I'm not saying you're only free to love Christ if at this moment you could all of a sudden hate him out of nowhere. That's what they would say. This is why you're only consistent with this view if you also teach you could lose your salvation, God doesn't know the future, all those kind of things. Notice that in all three situations, a person is compelled to say they love God, but for different reasons. Turn to Ezekiel 36. And I'll say this as you're turning there. You experience compatibilism long before you ever understand it. You've experienced compatibilism in your life right now. If you are a Christian, and I'll see some heads nodding, that'll be sufficient. Have you ever wanted to obey? Ever in your life? And it was truly you that wanted to obey? Ever? You guys are a little slow on the trigger here. Has a Christian, I mean, is it logical or even closely biblical for God to do such a work in your life that you actually like to obey? It is, right? And so you're here at church this morning. I'm hoping because you want to be here. Is it good to want to go to church? Yeah. Now, did you wake up this morning and go, well, God's got the gun to my back. I got to go to church. I mean, no, it's, yeah, I like going. I enjoy going. I like being obedient. Now, is that always? No, because I'm a fickle human being. I'm not glorified yet. But there are actually times in my life where, lo and behold, I actually do want to obey God. And it actually is me wanting to do it. This is why I say this. Ezekiel 36, verse 26. We'll start here. He says, I will give you a new what? Heart and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you and cause you to what? Walk in my statutes and be careful to what? Obey my rules. So you've experienced this already. There's a dual explanation. Why are you obedient as a Christian? Well, because I want to. But ultimately, what do we learn here? Who's causing your obedience? God. I mean, love, joy, peace, patience, kind. What are those the fruit of? The Spirit. So anytime you're happy, do you go, this isn't me, this is the Spirit, I'm not doing it. Like, this is just the Spirit taking over, I'm so happy right now. No, you go, I'm genuinely happy, and it genuinely is the Spirit causing me to be happy right now. Or loving, or kind, or any other fruit. Does that make sense? So you experience compatibilism long before you ever study it or encounter it. God guarantees right here in Ezekiel 36 that you will obey. And yet, in our daily experience, when we obey, it's because we want to. And the times we don't obey, it's because we didn't want to. That's how we experience it. This new work of regeneration produces a compelling inner desire to love Christ. So when God causes your heart to be new, when he gives you a new heart and gives you new desires, those new desires truly are yours. Like, I really do love Christ. But the only reason I love Christ is because God gave me a new heart. So am I loving Christ against my will? No, because I want to love Christ. I'm the one who wants to love him. But I know biblically I only want to love him because God has already done that work in my life to begin with. So God both secures my love for Christ and I actually have love for Christ. See how that's compatible? Does that make sense? Keep going here. Though this is a necessary result, as we read, obedience of God's determination, it is in no way a forced response. No Christian has ever said they love God against their will. You don't ever have a Christian who goes, I know I have to say I love God, but I really don't. Just play the part. No one says that. If you don't love God, you're not a Christian. This action is made meaningful if it's voluntary, not if you could have done something else. So their argument is this. If God gives you a new heart and that causes you to love Christ, and you can't help but love Christ, and that's not really freely loving Christ. I go, no, God does such a work in your heart that your desires now are to love Christ and you freely love him. Like I'm compelled to love him because I see him as beautiful. With blind eyes and a darkened mind and a dead heart, I didn't see Christ as beautiful. But now that the scales have fallen and the lights come on, I have a new heart and a new way of seeing Scripture and seeing Christ. I now see Christ as glorious and beautiful. I love him. That's the difference. Again, your definition of free will matters. So you've got two things left there on your sheet, heavenly love and Trinitarian love. Let me ask you this. In Romans 8, we won't turn there for time's sake, but in Romans 8, it says, those whom he foreknew, he predestined. Those he predestined, he called, justified, glorified, so on and so. The end is what? What's the ending of that golden chain? It's a G word. Glorified, okay? Does everyone in here agree that when we get to heaven, we will be perfected? Right? Will it be possible for you to sin in heaven? No, it won't be. Will it be possible for you to hate God in heaven? No. Does that then mean your obedience and your love for God is not genuine? No. And so you go, well, wait, first of all, libertarian, you've got the heavenly problem because there's coming a day where I'm guaranteed I will never sin again and I'm guaranteed that I will always love God perfectly. I will perfectly love God and I'll perfectly love my neighbor. That work of redemption will be perfected in me. And it won't even be possible or conceivable that I wouldn't do righteousness and love. And yet you're telling me because I can't do anything else, that's not freedom. Well, I can guarantee you this right now. You will be the most free you'll ever be when you get to heaven. Right? You will be freely loving and honoring God perfectly. So that's the heavenly love argument. This Trinitarian is the one that I want to end with. It takes a little bit more work. John 17. Turn to John 17, verse 22. And this one is the Trinity trump card, if you will. John 17. If you are familiar with the book of John, you know John 17 is actually the Lord's Prayer, where he is actually praying to the Father. He speaks a lot of language of what has gone on, you know, eternity past, the reason he came to earth, all these things. John 17, 22, listen to this. He says, the glory that that you have given me, I have given to them that they may be one, even as we are one. I and them and you and me, that they may become perfectly one so that the world would know that you sent me and loved them even as you loved me. So just real quick, does the Father love the Son? Okay. Verse 24, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am to see my glory, that you have given me because you loved me before the foundation of the world. Just again, let me ask you again, and this question has a purpose. Does the Father love the Son? Does the Son love the Father? Is it possible for them to not love one another? It's not. I mean, by their own very nature, they love one another. It's impossible for the Father to hate the Son and the Son to hate the Father and slam his door and run. I mean, if you're using that language, right? It's impossible for the Trinity to not love one another. It's impossible. And yet we still see it as a genuine love, don't we? I mean, imagine if one day one person of the Trinity just goes, I hate you guys. I'm going over here. It's like, that's not even conceivable. Like, it's not going to happen. And yet it's a genuine love, correct? The love between the Father and Son is obviously real and genuine. One basic truth that we must all confess is that God the Father and the Son have a loving relationship that is genuine and necessary. Listen to this. In this book, I stole this quote. Scott Christensen says, they love each other necessarily because their nature and character compel them to do so. Both willingly love and irresistibly love. And that is precisely what makes their relationship significant. Why is it significant that the Father loves the Son? Because the Father wants to love the Son. Why is it significant that the Son loves the Father? Because the Son wants to love the Father. Not because the Son could possibly hate him. It's that he's actually doing what he wants to do. Again, you see where our understanding of free will comes in. John 6, look at this. We're going to tie our love for Christ in with the Father's love for the Son. And this is one of those quotes that I sit back in my chair, think about it. I text Seth. I say, this is gold. He laughs. We talk about it. And then I go back to my lesson. I mean, this is a quote that just, oh man. So listen up, okay? In John 6:37, listen to this. All that the Father gives me, who's the me here? Jesus. All the Father gives me will come to me. So just real quick, if you are given to the Son by the Father, it's guaranteed what? You will come, okay? So that's guaranteed. All that the Father gives me will come to me, and whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. So real quick, if you're given by the Father to the Son, it's guaranteed you'll come. And then if you're given by the Father to the Son, you actually will come. You will come. You see that compatibilism there? I read this because of a quote, again, from Thaddeus, the other book here. You've got to realize biblically, behind your decision to come to the Son in faith was the decision of the Father to give you to the Son. Does that make sense? So the Father determines you will come, and yet think through all of your testimonies. I don't care what on earth your testimony is. The night you believed or the moment you believed, you wanted to believe. That's what you experienced. So there was no, oh, well, I've been given, my time's up, I got to go to the Son. Like, it's not how it happened. I remember the night in the dorm room where all of a sudden I loved Christ. I loved Scripture. Like, I was born again. I remember thinking, like, I believe this. Like, I love this now. Now later I see, oh, well, that work was done in me because I was given by the Father to the Son. He guaranteed it, but yet I truly did want it. At the same time, it's compatible. Behind your decision to come to the Son is the Father's decision to give you to the Son. This quote. Listen to this, okay? Once it sinks in that our belief in Jesus originates because the Father's love for his Son, we can never again think of the Trinity as some kind of abstract, black and white, strange math equation where 3 somehow equals 1. So real quick, he's saying, my love for the Son is a product of the Father giving me as a love gift to his Son. So we're caught up in this Trinitarian love. Does that make sense? The Father wants to give his Son a group of people. I'm one of those people, and so when I come to the Son and I love the Son, I'm being caught up in this process of the Father loving the Son. Do you get that relationship there? Listen again. He says, rather, the doctrine becomes something precious and practical. Talking about the Trinity. It bursts with color. It becomes a cool ocean to plunge into after we have followed John's map upstream from our rivers of faith and discovered their ultimate source in the triune God of love. Non-Calvinism, listen to this, non-Calvinism, or we'll say libertarian free will, reverses the order of the verbs. Listen, it says, libertarianism says all who come to the Son will be given to the Father, to the Son. Does that make sense? You have to reverse that or else you're going to be a compatibilist. For the compatibilist, we go, listen, God determined I would come and I came. For libertarian free will to be true, it would have to be reversed. Only those who come will be given to the Son. Do you see the difference in that? That's a huge difference. You're going to notice that flip-flop in a lot of places. Acts 13 is one of them, where it says, and the Gentiles rejoiced at the preaching of the word, and all who were appointed to eternal life believed. Well, if you're libertarian free will, you got to reverse that. All who believed were appointed to eternal life. That's not the way the Bible puts it. It's all that were appointed to eternal life believed. Here, it's all that are given to the Father will come. Not all who believe will be given. That's a distinction that needs to be made. He says, for John, however, we do not believe to become love gifts. Like, I don't become part of what the Father gives the Son because I love the Son. I love the Son because I'm part of what the Father's giving to the Son. It's a huge distinction. He says, all the Father gives me will come to the Son. For John, it lies beyond the scope of possibility that anyone the Father wants to give his Son as a living, conscious, worshiping creature says, I love you, and would not, in fact, come to the Son. So put it this way. He's saying, if libertarian free will would exist, not only would you have to reverse the order, but also picture this. The Father says, Son, I want to give you a group of people. I'm going to give them to you. And then all of them use their free will to say, no, we won't go. And so you've just stopped the Father from loving the Son. You go, like, I'm strong. I'm man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's what we mean by elevating man. That's what we mean. You've got to see the deep theological, eternal perspective of your salvation in order to understand these things that happen in real time. You loving the Son is a product of the Father loving the Son and giving you to him. not you have been given to the Son because one day you loved the Son. That's a very huge reverse, a huge reversal. The Father's love for the Son is real and genuine, just like our love for Christ is real and genuine, though it's determined because the Father gave us to the Son. John 14, look at this. John 14. John 14, 31. This love that Jesus has for the Father, which is genuine, explains why he endured the cross. This is one of the many explanations. But 14:31 says, "But I do as the Father has commanded me, so that the world may know that I what? I love the Father." Why does Jesus obey the Father? Because he loves him. Is it possible for Jesus to sin against the Father? To disobey the Father? No, it's not. And yet he's still saying, "I'm doing this because I love him." It's a genuine, real, willing love. Again, your definition of free will. Another quote from Thaddeus. Listen to this again. This is another golden quote. He says, "The atonement is effective." So what Christ did is effective because intra-Trinitarian love is not defective. Why is grace irresistible? Because if we could shun the Father's grace as he draws us to worship his Son, then we would have power to thwart God's expression of love for his Son. Grace cannot be resisted because his Trinitarian love cannot be frustrated. The saints are preserved because divine persons perfectly fulfill one another's will. You got to see yourself wrapped up in this Trinitarian love thing going on here, okay? I mean, the Father loves the Son, so that's why I love Christ. I will persevere to the end because Christ won't lose anything that the Father's given him. I mean, you're hearing all this biblical language now and it's starting to click. Why do I believe a Christian can't lose their salvation? Because the Father can't fail to love his Son, and the Son can't fail to obey his Father. And the Father has told him, "Don't lose anything that I've given you." All that to jump to the end here. This makes sense if you use a biblical definition of free will. The Father's love for the Son is genuine because he wants to love the Son. The Son's love for the Father is genuine because he wants to love the Father. The Christian's love for God is genuine because you want to love God. None of these are genuine because you could do something else. So imagine, if you will, God causes you to be born again. He gives you a heart that new desires, and you go, "I still hate Christ. It didn't work." That's not required in order to us freely love Christ. What's required to freely love Christ is that we actually freely love Christ. None of you were forced to believe when you believed. You believed because you were compelled to because of a new heart God gave you, and you love God. That's what happened. So now that we've been through this first argument, you can see how compatibilism handles the argument that if I can't do anything else but what I've done, then it's not genuine what I've done. That's not biblical. The Father can't not love the Son, yet his love is genuine. Son can't not love the Father, but his love is genuine. And as believers, when we're called to be born again, we can't help but love the Son, and yet our love is still genuine. So what about next argument? That's what we'll deal with next week. Next week, we'll deal with the argument that libertarian free will is required for accountability. We deal with this one next week, but I want you to think about it as you gear up for that. Try to come up with some sort of way that you biblically solve the tension of how can God be sovereign and man responsible? How can God guarantee his purposes will come to pass, yet everything that happens, man is responsible for? Judas was determined to betray the Son, yet Judas is guilty for betraying the Son. Pharaoh was raised up by God, but yet Pharaoh would not let the people go. How do you deal with that tension? That's what we'll talk about next week. Is man responsible if God's sovereign?